Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Automakers are seeing big drops in sales in the U.S., according to earnings reports released in recent days. Ford, Fiat, Chrysler, and Honda all saw new car sales in the U.S. drop by 7% last month compared to a year earlier. General Motors saw a slide of nearly 6%. And this comes after seven straight years of rising sales following the auto industry bailouts of 2009. So are the high times ending for the auto industry? Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She joins us from New York. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what's happening here? What's the reason for these big drop-offs in sales?
You know, I think there's a couple of factors. Records can't last forever, right? So part of this is just the economic cycle. A lot of people who needed a new car went out and bought one, and that's why we saw those record sales. I also think consumers who don't absolutely need a new car but might have treated themselves are holding off a little bit. This is kind of interesting. We've seen people saving instead of splurging on big-ticket items. I think that's good for their balance sheet. Not so good, maybe, if you're a car maker. And then the last thing I'm hearing is that there's a lot of supply of used and leased cars. Remember, during the financial crisis, you couldn't lease a car. That financing dried up. That's back. And now when they roll off lease, they're on the dealer lots as well. And if you've shopped for a car, you know a lot of them are a good deal. So people are opting for that instead of that brand new shiny vehicle.
But what you're saying is that we're seeing the same thing with cars that we are in retail in general right now, which is a little less spending, maybe a little more saving.
Yeah, well, yes, that is true. But I think what you're seeing in retail is something much bigger and a much more structural issue. And that's that big shift to online, right? People are buying cars online, but that's not having an impact on a sale. It's more just that economic cycle.
Are there certain types of vehicles that aren't selling?
Absolutely. Smaller cars. Gas has been relatively cheap, even though it's gone up a little bit this year. I mean, that's really pushed consumers back to those big SUVs and trucks that we love so much and away from those compacts that we were squeezing ourselves into and the more fuel-efficient cars. The fuel efficiency part is interesting for me because the car industries and auto companies made a lot of investment in that. And I keep asking them, you know, is that gone away? Are you going to pull back from that? They say no. They're doubling down. They believe that segment will come back. But I think that very much depends on what happens with gas and maybe some of those fuel efficiency standards that we know President Trump has asked the EPA to look into, maybe roll back.
Right. So what can we expect to happen as the year continues? Is this seen as just a blip or a trend that's likely to continue?
You know, I think that longer term, there's a question as to whether the younger generation wants to own a car. Why pay for the expense when you can just Uber everywhere, right? But my sense is that what we're seeing right now is that it is just more of a pullback after consecutive years of records. I don't think those records are necessarily coming back, but strong employment and rising wages should mean that we see a stabilization. I think the bigger issue is going to be jobs, though. You know, an industry that's operating at an even lower, slightly lower level is going to need less shifts and less workers. And those jobs, as we've seen, are not easily replaceable. And if you add in the trouble in malls and the big layoffs we've seen in retail, economists are watching this. This could be a little bit of a drag on jobs at a time when President Trump really wants to see success in that area. So it could become a political issue as well as an economic issue.
Because as we've seen in the past with the auto industry, there are supply lines that stretch very far from just the people who actually build the cars. This could have impacts on factories downstream.
Absolutely. This can have an impact across the whole industry, not just the automakers, but the parts and really the communities that spring up in these areas, too. Again, are we expecting major layoffs? No, we're not. But this is an industry that's automated a lot, too. And so when you even just lose a few shifts, you know, we're seeing them idled for the summer now in this slowdown. You know, will they come back online? Even if you're just one town who's dealing with that, there is a huge ripple effect. The auto industry, very important part of the economy.
And people may have noticed this already in a way because dealers are reporting that they're having trouble getting rid of extra inventory. They've got extra cars sitting at the dealerships.
That's right. And this is where, you know, an issue can be kind of difficult for the overall economy, but can be great for you as a consumer, because what are they going to do if they're left with inventory? They're going to discount. And we are seeing those incentives and discounts come back after hearing for years that the industry had weaned themselves off of it. So if you are shopping for a car, you may find that there are some pretty sweet deals out there, especially for older models, as dealers try to get those off the lot.
That's Maggie Lake, who hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, thanks as always.
Thanks.
Well, today, FBI Director James Comey made his most extensive comments about his decision just a week before the presidential election to tell Congress that he was reopening the Bureau's investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails. He spoke in a hearing today before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Look, this is terrible. It makes me mildly nauseous to think that we might have had some impact on the election. But honestly, it wouldn't change the decision. Everybody who disagrees with me has to come back to October 28th with me and stare at this and tell me what you would do. Would you speak or would you conceal? And I could be wrong, but we honestly made a decision between those two choices that even in hindsight, and this has been one of the world's most painful experiences, I would make the same decision.
Comey also faced questions about the investigation into Russia's interference with the U.S. election. Let's bring in NPR's Brian Naylor. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Robin.
And to the emails, these were emails that surfaced in another investigation, not one into Hillary Clinton. Comey has said before it was either, as he said today, be accused of concealing these new emails or announce the investigation, but the investigation led to nothing. It was closed just before the election. What more did he say about those Clinton emails, and how did the senators react to his defense?
Well, you know, Democrats are still very upset about how they believe Comey handled or, in their eyes, mishandled this investigation. The top Democrat on the committee, Dianne Feinstein of California, says she felt the decision by Comey to reopen the investigation just a week and a half before the election did have an impact on voting. She also expressed her dismay that the FBI didn't disclose until March that it was also investigating possible ties between the Trump campaign and Russian officials. So there is some Democrats were not happy. And even the Republican chair of the committee, Chuck Grassley of Iowa, said there's a cloud of doubt, in his words, hanging over the FBI, and that he hopes the FBI gets to the truth of its investigation into the possible links between the Russian government or Russian officials and the Trump campaign.
Well, someone added to that cloud of doubt yesterday. James Comey may have been so passionate there because he may have been reacting to Hillary Clinton, who also made her first extensive public comments on the election yesterday. She said she took absolute personal responsibility in an interview that she did in New York before an audience. But she also laid blame on losing the election on James Comey. Here she is speaking to CNN's Christiane Amanpour.
But I was on the way to winning until the combination of Jim Comey's letter on October 28th and Russian WikiLeaks raised doubts in the minds of people who were inclined to vote for me but got scared off.
In fact, she said if the election had happened on October 27th, before James Comey's letter on October 28th to Congress, I'd be your president. This had to have added to his comments today.
Yeah, well, so he laid out the background that, you know, essentially he had previously cleared Clinton of any intentional mishandling of classified emails from her time as Secretary of State. And then the agents came across this laptop from Anthony Weiner, who they're investigating for possibly sexting with an underage girl. I found, you know, thousands of emails, Comey said, that the FBI didn't think that they had seen before. And so he had this tough decision to make. And, you know, there were two doors, as he explained it, one labeled conceal, that is not tell anyone that the Bureau was looking at these emails. The other one said speak. And he said that, you know, if he didn't speak, if he didn't tell Congress what was going on, it would have been catastrophic to the Bureau's independence.
Well, when you lay it out the way we just have, you know, it's a presidential election and email surface and there's a sexting accusation.
Yeah.
You could not make this up. But meanwhile, you mentioned Democrats outraged that while we heard about the Clinton investigation before the election, we did not hear about ongoing investigations into Russian interference and possible Trump ties. Senators also questioned Comey about those investigations today. Here's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham.
Is it fair to say that the Russian government is still involved in American politics?
Yes.
Is it fair to say we need to stop them from doing this?
Yes, fair to say.
Do you agree with me? The only way they're going to stop is for them to pay a price for interfering in our political process?
I think that's a fair statement.
Brian Naylor, did we hear anything more, though, about how far the investigation's gone into any Trump ties to Russian interference?
Very little at all, Robin. All he would basically do, Comey would do, is to confirm that the investigation continues. He maintains that he treated it the same way that he had initially treated the Clinton investigation, that is, not talking about it. And then he said that we're not going to say another peep about it if he has his way until the investigation is done, and he gave no indication of when that might be.
Brian, I want to get to one last sound. Senator Richard Blumenthal asked James Comey if he had any regrets.
The only thing I regret is that maybe answering the phone when they called to recruit me to be FBI director when I was living happily in Connecticut.
And we would welcome you back to Connecticut.
Yeah, but I can't. And I've gotten all kinds of rocks thrown at me, and this has been really hard. But I think I've done the right thing at each turn. I'm not on anybody's side. So hard for people to see that. But I've asked that a million times. Should you have done this? Should you have done that? And the honest answer, I don't mean to say arrogant, is I wouldn't have done it any differently.
Brian, quite human moments today.
Yeah, you know, it must be difficult, too. He's getting pressure from President Trump, who just sent out some tweets last night saying Comey was the best thing that had ever happened to Hillary Clinton. So he's certainly getting it from all sides on this.
NPR's Brian Naylor. Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
We're awaiting the arraignment in the case of Corey Ali Muhammad, the man who said he shot and killed three white men last month in Fresno, California, because, as he told a local news station, white supremacy has to die. His lawyer says he's mentally ill. He's said he's a follower of the Nation of Islam. What does that mean? The Black Nationalist Organization was founded in the early 1900s by Wallace D. Fard, who said he was Muslim, but unlike mainstream Muslims, claimed to be Allah in the flesh. Leadership passed to Elijah Muhammad. Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali famously joined in the late 1950s. At the same time, a television documentary, The Hate That Hate Produced, was broadcast. Here's a clip from host Mike Wallace.
A group of Negro dissenters is taking to street corner stepladders, church pulpits, sports arenas, and ballroom platforms across the United States to preach a gospel of hate that would set off a federal investigation if it were preached by Southern whites. What are they saying? Listen.
I charge the white man with being the greatest liar on earth. I charge the white man with being the greatest drunkard on earth. I charge the white man with being the greatest swine eater on earth.
Our next guest says you have to put that and other language in the context of lynchings and the KKK. But the Southern Poverty Law Center calls the Nation of Islam a hate group. Zain Abdullah is an associate professor of religion and society and Islamic studies at Temple University. Professor, tell us more about the core beliefs of the nation at its founding.
Well, the Nation of Islam sort of combined what we would call religious black nationalism with some of the traditional teachings of Islam globally. So the combination often confounded people because many people weren't accustomed to a kind of nationalist dialogue or rhetoric mixed with religion. And so they always have to sort of unpack that idea that they are Muslims, but they're also addressing a black condition of suffering.
And they believed that there was a paradise on earth that had been destroyed by a wizard who created the white devil. So the white devil, the blue-eyed devil, was a thinking early on in the group, which does differentiate them from the Muslim faith. And as we go through the history, we see the leaders are virulently anti-Semitic, anti-whites. Malcolm X joins the group, but Martin Luther King begins referring to them as a hate group. That's in the late 50s as well. We have so many instances of whites propelled by the KKK or by white supremacists or hate groups killing blacks. Are there other instances of blacks who are members of Nation of Islam killing whites?
Early on in this early history, the 1930s, there was one incident when that happened among the early members. And again, it was a response to the lynching of over 5,000 black people in the South and with no kind of repercussion at all. But since then, though, we actually haven't noticed or heard anything like that. The Nation is a self-defense organization. They believe in self-defense. They don't believe in turning the other cheek. They actually do not believe in perpetuating violence against anyone. What you mentioned earlier about the Nation of Islam cosmology, the creation myth, was just that. It was a way to explain how black people became disempowered, became victims of a white supremacist system. And many people who joined the Nation of Islam did not really rehearse that as much. I mean, they understood the story, But they weren't there for that story. They were there for black empowerment, economic, social kind of unity, fight against police brutality, the kind of social conditions that drew them to the organization.
Well, Malcolm X eventually split from the group because of some of the rhetoric. And along comes Louis Farrakhan, who begins leading the group. And then Malcolm X was assassinated. Did Farrakhan order that?
No. Farrakhan has professed always that he did not order any assassination. But he did admit that he participated in creating a climate that could have produced that kind of result. And he apologized for, you know, being a part of a nation that sought to defend itself against any kind of recrimination.
Farrakhan, though, did go on to build an empire. Educational training programs, self-sufficiency programs, we mentioned, bakeries, restaurants, fish markets, a line of hair and skin products. Where is the Nation of Islam today?
Well, the Nation of Islam today, the main group of the Nation of Islam, because they have some splinter groups, but the main group is headed by Minister Louis Farrakhan out of Chicago.
He still leads it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And they have mosques, as they call them now. They used to call them temples. They have mosques throughout the country, perhaps over 100. They are involved in political activism. They're involved in a social critique. They're involved, most importantly, in a kind of moral discipline that they try to rehearse constantly. And against their self-professed Muslims. In 1961, C. Eric Lincoln dubbed them black Muslims, which they rejected. They don't see themselves as black Muslims. They see themselves as Muslims who happen to be racially black.
Well, and don't some Muslims in this country reject them because of the early rhetoric about Jews, about whites?
Well, many Muslims in the Muslim world, what we call Sunni Muslims or traditional Muslims, reject their rhetoric about God coming in the person of a man.
Yeah.
That's a huge violation in Islam. Also, they rejected them for the way in which they responded to white racism by calling whites devils and seeing them mythically as inherently evil. But again, that response was to the system of white supremacy.
I mean, this was just written not that long after slavery, to put in that context. But what about Farrakhan's words? They linger. You know, here he talks about Jews. Who are the slumlords in the black community, the so-called Jews? Those false Jews promote the filth of Hollywood that's seeding the American people and the people of the world, bringing you down in moral strength. This is repulsive.
Yes, it is. It is. And Minister Farrakhan has been very controversial around these issues. But he has also tried to put his statements into context. Unfortunately, again, it's political. But he tries to also explain that he's not an anti-Semite. He's not homophobic. He's not a racist. But he does make these controversial statements. Absolutely.
But, you know, we live in a time when people are very critical of President Trump. They say things like words matter. Has the Nation of Islam distanced itself from this kind of white supremacy? We know that there are white supremacist groups who actually over the years tried to embrace the Nation of Islam. Hey, we both want separatism. Right. We both want to be able to say how much we hate the other. That couldn't have been appreciated by members of the Nation of Islam. So is there a move to withdraw earlier words?
Well, the Nation of Islam does not perpetuate hate of whites, but because they respond to white racism. In fact, the idea of calling whites devils predates the Nation of Islam. Even the Chinese during the Boxer Rebellion called their white oppressors devils. So it's a way of inverting or changing the narrative about demonized peoples or degraded peoples. As you say, words matter. So their words are a reaction to a kind of Jim Crow system. And so this is their response in terms of words.
Well, meanwhile, who do you think the successor to Louis Farrakhan is? In 1995, he led the Million Man March. He was also very controversial when Jesse Jackson was running for president. Jesse Jackson had to disavow him and the Nation of Islam. But, you know, what direction do you think?
And so did President Obama also had to disavow him as well.
So what direction do you think Nation of Islam goes in now and who might lead it?
Well, he's refused to name a successor at this point. But he does have national leaders among his sons. They actually operate on the national level. And they have also regional leaders as well. So like his spiritual father, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, at this point, he has refused to name a successor.
By the way, what do you think about the fact that the Southern Poverty Law Center has listed the Nation of Islam as a hate group?
You know, when I talk to members of the nation, they don't think much of it. They believe that it is a mischaracterization of the group. Farrakhan continually denounces that moniker, that they are a hate group. It's very familiar and reminiscent of the program called the hate produced in covering the Nation of Islam. And so I think because they're a black nationalist organization, they are seen as also perpetuating the same kinds of prejudice. And I just think that there needs to be more information on that.
Well, but you just cannot whitewash, you'll forgive the term, some of Louis Farrakhan's comments about not just whites, but Jews.
No, right. Yeah. Absolutely.
And gays and Catholics.
That's right. Yeah. No, I totally agree.
Yeah. That's Zain Abdullah, Associate Professor of Religion and Society and Islamic Studies at Temple, also the author of Black Mecca, The African Muslims of Harlem. Professor, pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, perhaps timely. This was the sound at Fenway Park last night when Baltimore Orioles center fielder Adam Jones, who is black, came to bat against the Boston Red Sox.
Number 10, Adam Jones.
Applause. But the night before, Jones heard the N-word from some Red Sox fans. Others pelted him with peanuts. After that, Red Sox outfielder Mookie Betts tweeted to the fans, "Literally stand up tonight. Say no to racism." Last night, fans did, and Adam Jones was clearly moved by the ovation he received.
I just appreciate what they did. You know, I've never, on the road, gotten any ovations or anything like that, so it just caught me off guard a little bit. So I just was like, oh, okay, this is something different, and I just wanted to get in the box and get on with the game.
The Red Sox were the last Major League Baseball team to integrate in 1959, 12 years after Jackie Robinson first broke the color barrier, joining the Brooklyn Dodgers. Today, sports observers, black and white, say that while Boston has come a long way in addressing racism on and off the field, this week's incident shows there is still work to do.
President Trump welcomed Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas to the White House today, an attempt to revive the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. The two leaders gave a joint statement. Here's President Trump.
We'll start a process which hopefully will lead to peace. Over the course of my lifetime, I've always heard that perhaps the toughest deal to make is the deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Let's see if we can prove them wrong.
Abbas, for his part, expressed confidence in the Trump administration. Here he is through an interpreter.
Mr. President, we believe that we are capable and able to bring about success to our efforts because, Mr. President, you have the determination and you have the desire to see it become to fruition and to become successful.
NPR's Daniel Estrin is in Jerusalem. Daniel, welcome.
Thank you.
And what's the significance of this visit today?
Well, this is a really big boost for Abbas. You know, at first, he felt cut out of the equation. Trump was seen as very close to Israel, and the Palestinian leadership publicly complained that it hadn't managed to have any contact with the Trump team at first. And that has all changed. The Palestinians are very positive about Trump now. Trump's envoy, Jason Greenblatt, came to the region. He met not only President Abbas, but he also met Palestinians from a refugee camp. He even tweeted that he made a new Palestinian friend in Jerusalem. You know, and now President Abbas is at the White House. And for Abbas, this is a chance to kind of one-up Netanyahu. Netanyahu got his time in front of the cameras at the White House. Now Abbas has his chance at the White House.
But how much power and control does Abbas have among Palestinians?
It's a good question. You know, for the U.S., Abbas has had a lot of support for many years because Abbas rejects violence. He says he supports a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Back home among his people, he's not very popular. He does not have very much support. First of all, he's 82 years old. He's been in office for 12 years, and his term was only supposed to last 5 years. And his leadership is divided. He controls the West Bank, but Palestinians in Gaza are under the control of his rival, Hamas.
Right.
But for Palestinians, they look at Abbas and they don't see that he has managed to make any kind of progress in terms of peace, in terms of ending the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. And today, while Abbas is at the White House, Palestinians back home are kind of shrugging their shoulders at that meeting. They're actually a lot more interested in rallying not for Abbas today, but in support of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. They're on a hunger strike.
Hmm. Trump and Abbas have announced today that they are going to start the peace process. What are the risks there?
You know, every time there have been peace efforts, Israelis and Palestinians have met at the negotiating table many times. But when peace talks have collapsed, sometimes that's been followed by violence. And when peace efforts have failed, Israelis and Palestinians have become even more cynical and more hopeless about the chances for their being a chance for peace in the future. So if Trump inflates the expectations for making progress towards peace, and then that process fails, there could be more hopelessness, there could be violence, and it could make it even harder to try to talk peace again.
That's NPR's Daniel Estrin speaking to us from Jerusalem. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A first-of-its-kind deal between a Massachusetts health insurer and a major American drug manufacturer could dramatically change how insurers and patients pay for medicine. It's a money-back guarantee for a drug called Repatha that lowers bad cholesterol. Martha Biebinger from Here and Now contributor WBUR explains how it works.
For years now, health insurers have been trying to pay for performance, and they're making headway with doctors and hospitals. But for the most part, the price of your blood thinner or antacid is not based on whether it works or not. Dr. Michael Sherman says that's starting to change. He's the chief medical officer at Harvard Pilgrim, Massachusetts' second largest health insurer. And Sherman says the deal he just made is a big leap, a money-back guarantee on a cholesterol-lowering drug.
What is really groundbreaking is if people who are on Repatha have a heart attack or certain types of strokes, despite being on the drug, Amgen will refund all the money paid, 100% of it, both to the health plan and to the individual.
Amgen is the California-based company that makes Repatha. Dr. Josh Offman is a senior vice president for global value, access, and policy.
We want to stand behind the value of our products. We want to put skin in the game. And we think by partnering with payers, we can improve the ability for high-risk patients to get access to the products they need.
Many insurers have refused to pay for Repatha because it costs $14,000 a year, as compared to $200 to $500 a year for some common generic drugs that reduce cholesterol. And Repatha is not dozens of times more effective. Dr. Pradeep Natarajan, a preventive cardiologist at Mass General, says Repatha seems to help a select group of cardiac patients, but not all those who are eligible for the drug.
Couldn't in good faith recommend spending $14,000 per year for this. So I think broadly, it doesn't make sense at the current price point.
Working hard to lower your LDL bad cholesterol?
Amgen is using direct-to-consumer ads to boost sales for Repatha, what was supposed to be a blockbuster drug. And the money-back guarantee may persuade more insurers to pay for Repatha. But David Mitchell, president of Patients for Affordable Drugs, says a full refund doesn't address the real problem.
This is not an arrangement that meets the needs of patients. It is an arrangement that allows the drug companies to maintain their high prices and claim that they're doing something to address those prices, when in fact they're not.
And Mitchell is not impressed with a money-back guarantee.
That seems like a bad deal, especially if I'm dead.
Many patients do survive a stroke or heart attack, of course, and a refund could help keep drug prices, one of the fastest rising parts of the healthcare system, in check. And Harvard Pilgrim says they hope this contract will serve as a model for much more expensive personalized drugs that are on their way to the market. For Here and Now, I'm Martha Biebinger.
Well, you know that saying, laughter is the best medicine? Well, if true, Carl Hyacin has been practicing without a license for years. He is the doggedly satirical observer of all things wacky in Florida, in both his columns for the Miami Herald and well over a dozen books. In the 2016 novel Razor Girl, he weaves together insurance fraud, beach erosion, the mob, reality TV, and real headlines about Floridians. By the way, a warning, they are real, but they may not be for everyone. Real headlines like, Manatee Woman Punches Sister in Fight Over Vibrator, deputies say, and Florida Woman Causes Accident While Shaving Private Parts. That last real person inspired the title character of Razor Girl, which is out in paperback this week. We spoke with Carl Hyacin when the book was first published. Carl, I think we actually talked at one point when we were talking about these crazy headlines that come out of Florida. I think we did talk about the 2010 true story about the woman shaving herself.
Right, and had caused an accident down in the Keys. She was doing some personal grooming while she was driving, and she crashed into a car full of tourists. So one of my sons sent me that clipping, and I'd saved it, of course, trying in some depraved way to fit it into a novel. First of all, how do you improve on it in fiction? And then where would it go? So I said, why don't I start the book with something like that and see what happens?
This is why other authors just get so angry at you, Carl Hyacin, because you're so lucky. You just have these headlines, these stories about Floridians. How many others in your book? I mean, there's so many storylines. You've got a cop who's had his badge removed because of coloring outside the lines. You've got somebody who shores up shorelines. What's the name of the company?
Sedimental Journeys. Yeah, beach renourishment is a huge business in Florida because erosion is a continuous problem, and the beach is an expensive commodity. I mean, we sell the image of beaches and we sell property on the beaches. And so when the beach starts disappearing, they turn to these companies to either dredge up sand from offshore and redo the beach, or actually in many cases they go to the Bahamas and get sand. And the guy in my book, the scammer in my book, decides that Cuba would be a good place to try to get some sand. He's gotten into trouble with the mob because he brought in some really bad sand.
From a landfill. It had glass in it.
And there's, you know, so all the kids building sandcastles are sitting there getting shredded. And so the mafia said, you put in a good beach or else.
Well, you've got your central character, Andrew Yancey, who also appeared in your Bad Monkey. He's a former detective now busted down to health inspector for restaurants. A big case comes up when it's discovered that this is so disgusting, so disgusting. Somebody has shaved their beard in a pot of like gumbo or something.
Quinoa. I don't go for the gumbo. No, it's quinoa.
At this health restaurant. Do you get people like health inspectors sidling up to you and kind of saying, I got a story for you?
I don't have to do that, Robin, because in Florida, because of the public records law, all restaurant inspections can be looked up online. I go out to eat all the time and the food's great. But if you want to find something that'll make you want to sleep with the lights on, just read a few of these reports from some of the sketchier places. And I take my character, Andrew Yancey, and put him in this situation. And he was a hotshot detective working on like real crime, and now he's literally counting cockroach wings on roach patrol.
But talking about restaurants, I think it was also a restaurant where this huge rodent-like thing runs through, and then the owner says, oh, yeah, that's Hemingway's cat.
Right. He's trying to tell. It's actually what it is there's a species, an invasive species in the Keys that's a real thing that I put in a book called a Gambian pouch rat. Actually, they're called giant Gambian pouch rats, and they were released on an island called Grassy Key several years ago after they didn't flourish in the pet trade. Not surprisingly, not many people wanted to buy a 9-pound rat as their household pet. So the business tanked. And this guy in real life, he didn't know what to do with the rat, so he just let him go. And there's sightings occasionally in the Keys, and it's always intrigued me. So I decided to put a small herd of them in this novel and have them show up in one of Yancey's restaurant patrols. But they're the largest rat on the planet. I know that that's probably not appealing to you, but it was to me as a novelist.
Well, others have wondered there's a silliness, but also a scathingness in some of your commentary. Janet Maslin, the New York Times, points out that you're kind of skewering the nature of our country right now in the center of the new book because there's a reality show, Bayou Brethren. It's a duck dynasty, except there's a group of brothers who are actually from Wisconsin who have been trained how to speak Cajun.
They have a Cajun dialect. Yeah, sure.
And what's the name of their church?
It's the Holy Tabernacle of Chickapaw, something like that. They had a fake church built so that they could give fake sermons. If you write satire, you're looking at the whole big picture, what's going on in the country. And that whole section of the novel was devised and written long before the Republican convention this summer, when one of the actual Duck Dynasty guys gets up and addresses the grand old party of the United States. I mean, I couldn't have invented that. Tom Wolfe couldn't have invented that scene. So if you're writing satire, you're trying to stay ahead of the absurdity, and sometimes it catches up with you. And this is the year I think it's catching up.
Well, and your character who allegedly runs this chicken farm or something, again, who is in reality from Wisconsin with his brothers, turns out to be, he says racist things, and he's got people who believe him.
They worship him. They hang on every word. And I mean, he's just an accordion player from Wisconsin, and he's trained to be a redneck reality star. And all of a sudden, he's looking himself in the mirror because there's a guy on the other side who actually is believing all the stuff that he's saying.
Well,
and that's what I think is a real phenomenon, is that you – all the talk that, and the hate and the bigotry that you stir up with rhetoric sometimes comes home to roost. And in this particular – for this particular character who's really just trying to make a buck on TV, he's now facing somebody who's really dangerous, who thinks everything he says is gospel.
Miami Herald columnist and author Kyle Hyacin. The latest book is Razor Girl. Google it. Carl, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks for having me back.
Virginia is one of only two states that have gubernatorial elections this year. The other is New Jersey. But Virginia is the only state where governors can't serve consecutive terms. They can only serve one four-year term at a time. So what does that mean for the office? Joining us now via Skype is Larry Sabato, who is the director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. Larry, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
Well, what do you think, first of all, are the advantages of limiting a state governor to just one four-year term?
For one thing, you do concentrate the mind of a governor when he or she knows that there's only 4 years in the term and it's not immediately renewable. Remember, a governor can serve non-consecutive terms, and we've had one that did that in the 60s and 70s. But if you've only got 4 years and you've got big plans, you have to get right to work. You can't waste a day. I think that does benefit the state in some ways.
What are the disadvantages?
The disadvantages are the discontinuity. Clearly, other states who have governors serve 2, 3, 4 terms get to know business leaders at home and abroad. It probably gives them an advantage in negotiating trade deals. And many of our governors have complained about that.
Why does Virginia do it this way? Does this go all the way back to Thomas Jefferson?
No, Mr. Jefferson had no role in this. It actually was established in 1851 during a constitutional revision. And it was considered a progressive reform at the time because Virginia's term, gubernatorial term, like most states, had been much shorter, 1, 2, 3 years. So this was an expansion of the term to 4 years. And to balance that, they made it a one-term limit, which, by the way, 14 other states have had for long durations in American history.
The two senators from Virginia right now are both former governors. Is the position of governor now seen as a stepping stone to being a senator, which, of course, you can do for life if you keep getting reelected?
That's been the tradition recently. You know, most of our governors have been elected to the Senate or tried to get to the Senate. There's a phrase in Virginia that's been used for many, many decades, no higher honor. Supposedly, there is no higher honor than being governor, and everything else is a step down. I don't think that applies anymore.
What do you think would happen in the U.S. overall if the president were limited to one term?
Well, it depends on whether you like or dislike the president. I think the current system under the 22nd Amendment is probably about right. Two terms. Some still argue that we should go back to the system of unlimited terms, and that allows for someone like Franklin Roosevelt in time of national emergency to keep running. It wouldn't work at the national level. There's no chance of that happening. And Virginia is the last remaining state with 1 4-year term.
So if you look at what's actually happening in the Virginia gubernatorial race right now, we've got on the Democratic side, Ralph Northam, the lieutenant governor, who seemed to be guaranteed the nomination. But then Representative Tom Perriello, the former congressman, announced in January that he would challenge Northam. What's going on the Democratic side?
It's a very competitive race to the extent that we can see it. And it's difficult to project it at this point.
And what about on the Republican side?
On the Republican side, there are three candidates. The leading candidate is Ed Gillespie, a former RNC chair, and he almost won the Senate seat of Senator Mark Warner in 2014. He lost by a fraction of 1% of the vote. So he's expected to get the nomination.
Is President Trump expected to be a central focus, do you think, of the gubernatorial race?
If the Democrats have their way, of course he will be the central focus. Hillary Clinton managed to carry Virginia pretty handily, 5 percentage points, and Virginia was the only southern state, if you can still call Virginia a southern state, to vote for Clinton. So Democrats have some advantage there, and since 1977, with only one exception, the governor elected has been of the opposite party of the sitting president. Our gubernatorial elections are always 1 year after the presidential election. So there is some kind of midterm effect. Donald Trump is very unpopular in Virginia. His popularity is somewhere in the 30s. So that's not a good sign for the Republican. On the other hand, Democrats could wound themselves with a tough primary, and the Democrat could limp into the general election. You just don't know.
And the current Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe will become the ex-governor, one of many, many ex-governors of Virginia. What do they end up doing after they're done if they don't run for another seat?
They tend to congregate frequently for ceremonies. I've certainly seen the lineup many, many times over the years. And you're right, we do have more former governors than almost any other state. Since there are only two Senate seats, they can't all run for that.
Right.
We've had some governors seek to run for the presidency. George Allen and Jim Gilmore, two examples. And Mark Warner briefly ran in 2008. But generally speaking, most of our former governors don't serve in public office again.
That's Larry Sabato, the director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia, where governors can only serve one term. Larry, thank you.
Thanks so much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.